My name is Michelle Blacksmith. I am conducting an interview with three artists today. Their names are Wendy Bridgeforth, Shauna Melton, and Ina Lisa Anderson. It is Wednesday, May 16th, 2018. I live at 52 Plymouth Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and my age is 56. Wendy, please identify yourself.
Hello, my name is Wendy Bridgeforth. I live in Bridgeport, Connecticut. I reside at 890 Seaview Avenue. I am 66 years old, and I am an artist.
My name is Shauna Melton. I'm from Bridgeport, Connecticut. I live in Reed's Art Space, 1042 Broad Street in Bridgeport. I'm 39 years old, and I am an artist.
Hello, my name is Ina Alisa Anderson. I live in the city of Bridgeport, 205 Harriet Street. I am 59 years old and also a playwright, director, writer, and artist.
Okay. Thank you. This interview is taking place at St. Mark's Daycare Center on Newfield Avenue in Bridgeport, Connecticut on May 16th, 2018. And so for each artist, I'm going to ask first the same question. What media or genre of art do you create? How did you, or where were you when you began to create, and also when you became aware of your talent? And what year was that approximately? And I will prompt you if you don't remember all the questions as you're going. It's fine. So Wendy, let's begin with you. And what media or genre of art do you work in?
I generally paint with acrylics. Right now, I'm getting into watercolors. I'm trying to start up my creativity by picking a medium that I find is a challenge. And I'm enjoying it. I currently go down to Seaside Park and paint watercolors. I mean, the seascape, which is classical, but I always thought it was archaic. And I've changed my mind. When it gets warmer, you will see me down at Seaside Park doing seascape. As a child, I always was creative. I loved painting. Every time we had an art teacher, which used to come every 6 weeks in the school system, I just knew I wanted to be an artist. I didn't know what it was, what it entailed, or anything, but that's what I wanted to do. And just my stubbornness, I persevere and I attacked it. I told my mother I'm going to art school. I just had this whole general idea. Even though there was nobody of my gender or ethnicity that I knew, I didn't know, have any knowledge. I was very naive, but I pursued it and got lucky through counselors with the ABCD program, Mr. Miller.
And about what year was that?
Okay, I will say, okay, I graduated in the 70s, so in the 70s. That's when I started, when I actually went to art school. Okay. So.
And Shauna, what about you? What media or genre do you employ to create?
I'm a poet, so words, and a painter, so paint. And I don't necessarily like to, sometimes I combine them. So I don't pick one over the other. I think they're of equal importance. I think that I did, as far as I can remember, because I've been doing it, seems like my whole life, I think the words came first. But I had my first poem published when I was 12. And I left a poem at my grandmother's house after spending a week there. And she sent it off to a contest, and I won by getting published. And that was the first time I actually shared my work, and it wasn't even in my control. The reason why I got started, I think it was a tapping out, and leave it to me to have my tapping out be a tuning in kind of thing. But I remember my parents would argue a lot. My father had a lot of issues with addiction, and you know, they would fight a lot, and my escape was creating. And I would always color and paint and do things. And it wasn't until my grandmother sent that poem off that I realized that I could do more with it than just serve myself. So that was the beginning of the journey. But I think the actual beginning was really just needing an escape of reality. I would get coloring books at the Scholastic fairs, and they had the step-by-step books on how to draw cartoon characters like Fred Flintstones and what was the dog? And they were living in the future.
The Jetsons?
The Jetsons. Yeah. And Scooby-Doo, and you could get step-by-step tutorial. It was like a book, a tutorial on how to draw them. I would draw the Cheerios bee and just copy things that I saw. And then I think when I started becoming a little more spiritually attuned and trusting myself a little more, I started using my visions. I'm not sure exactly when that happened, but I know that it happened around high school when I started.
And about what time period is that? About what date?
I graduated in 97, so I would say around 95, 96, I started doing my own thoughts and ideas. Nobody knew I was a painter until about 2001. Everybody knew me for poetry. High school, I was published, I was doing all this stuff. Nobody knew I painted until about 2001.
Okay. And Ina, how about you?
Oh, what was the first question?
What medium or genre do you use to create?
I use vocals. I'm a singer. And playwriting, acting, and whatever else I can get my hand on, I guess. I started when I was, young. I say about 3 years old for the singing and the acting. I used to mimic commercials, and Camay soap was my moment. You know, I used to always tell everyone about how their face could look so lovely using Camay soap. And so that was my debut. I started singing in public probably when I was about 14. I actually started doing all of it in public. I'd say about 14 years old, singing, maybe about 12. Singing, the acting, because once I got into middle school, when Eastside Middle School, you know, we had the choir, and so that's when I started displaying my talents. Okay. Yeah.
All right. And about what time period was that?
Oh, the early 70s, late 60s. Yeah.
And you were in high school during what period?
From 72 to 76.
Okay. All right. And so now, second question that I'll ask of each of you, who or what are some of your influences, art influences?
Well, I can say after I did my 1 year of college, which unfortunately closed, that was located in New Canaan.
What was the name of it?
Silvermine College of Art. It had a very renowned reputation, but unfortunately financially, they didn't handle things well. But it was a good school, and I was one of the few blacks there from Bridgeport. I ran into other artists that attended the school and I didn't know. Jimmy Saunders was one of them. I lost my train of thought.
So I was asking you about art influences, who or what?
Well, when I started working at the Art Center, it was Ben Johnson, Jerry Johnson, Bill Collins, visually, they were the ones that got my creativity in painting going, because at the time, I wasn't going for painting, I was going for sculpture, wood sculpture, because I was more proficient and did that much better when I was at Silvermine, because painting just didn't get it for me, although I wanted it to. So they were my influence, and all the artists that came into the Art Center. And when we would have our paintings and everything like that, and the process of working with the kids, they were my influence. I loved that job. I couldn't believe I was fortunate enough to work in that place around people that were so creative, the musicians that came through there, like, Jamin and Ralph Uhuru Williams and Haywood Clark and Buster, I forget his last name.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so it was my time with working with the Art Center, mm-hmm. ABCD Cultural Arts Center.
Right, and what years were those?
This was in 72. 72, I worked like maybe 6 years, and then I broke off. I went up to Hartford Art School, and then I did a couple of years there and came back and was fortunate enough to get employed back with the Art Center when it relocated to Gary Crooks on the West End, back of PT Barton.
Thank you. Shana, what about your influences, the who and or the what?
I have historical legendary influences, and I also find myself inspired by artists now, probably equally. And so I would say there's like the Maya Angelou, the Nikki Giovanni, Amir Baraka, the Last Poet. I've been blessed with the opportunity to meet and share space and time with a lot of them. So beyond their work, it's also the lesson of making yourself available to younger artists. And learning and teaching, correcting. So those are definitely huge influences with like painters. I love an artist. I love like Judy Chicago, Frida Kahlo, Jacob Lawrence. Kara Walker is amazing. I love her work. I think with as far as people I know, I'm surrounded by a lot of artists. And I feel like my friend Ayaba is always saying how when we take pictures, how this picture is going to be how we look at those pictures of like Nikki Giovanni and Maya chilling, right? So I hope that with the work we do, our work carries over to their level. And so there is like Ayaba. I have a group of girlfriends here and in Hartford, like Mind Evolution and Lynette Johnson. And they're very authentic poets, and they tell stories even when, you know, it can be debated. They stay true to what they believe and what they know. There's Tantra, Queen Goddess. They're all incredible poets. Then, and friends, right, beyond the stage. And then there's people like Stephen Lopez. He's an artist out of California. And I found him doing an After Midnight series. And it was all the famous black R&B singers like Sade and Minnie Riperton and India Ari, and he actually inspired me to do time-lapse videos of my work because he was doing time-lapse videos of his work. And so I find a lot of inspiration from the people around me, which I think is a gift because a lot of people struggle with that, and I've learned that. It's not something I've ever taken for granted, but when you see people who don't have that, you understand the value. So I definitely find it in the previous generation, but I think there's also a lot existing now.
Okay, thank you. Ina, how about you? Who or what are some of your influences?
That's my homie.
In the earlier years, my mother's sister and brothers were Philadelphianites. I spent a lot of time in Philly. I have a cousin who is now deceased, Edwin Chambers Spanky, he was called in the industry. Wonderful guitar player who has had the pleasure of playing all across this country, around the world, and in different genres. And we would get together and just cut up and experiment and just do what it was that we did. So the street that my aunt lived on, 28th Street, there were singers like the Three Degrees, and you know, they would come to the house and we would go down in the basement and have jam sessions, or we would end up going to Uptown Theater, and Aunt Pearl would have everybody at her house after the shows were over. So, you know, you get to just meet artists and people. And a lot of that stuff, I think when I was young, I just kind of took for granted, you know, that this is what people do. Later on, always found myself strange. We grew up in Father Panic. I grew up in Father Panic. But inside our house was very Southern. The floors were always very shiny. My mother always kept the apartment very immaculate. We would do stuff like go out and get chickens, like, and pull the eggs from the chick. Just crazy stuff, you know, inside the house. But from that, music, everything, you know, whether it was jazz and John Coltrane, and whether it was R&B and when funk came out, you know, the biggest challenge I had was, how am I going to say this word in the presence of my mom and get away with it, you know? You know, so I can remember the first time, I think it was Parliament Funkadelic, I'm gonna funk you right on up. Yeah, you know, so I'm just sitting there singing, and my mother was like, what did you say? You know, I'm like, it's funk, mom, F-U-N-K. You know, and that was like this far from getting the taste slapped right out your mouth, you know. Or the Nasty Girls, you know. I think we lived in a time where we were able to see the change, the rhythm, the flow of music when hip-hop first started entering in and just, you know, the revolution will not be televised. It was. And so when I think of music, I think of them in categories, because that's how I best remember them. And so that in the 60s, in the early 60s, when black people were going through, you know, and the artists started changing their songs to social songs, Marvin Gaye became they became social. That was our mode of communication, of how to get ready as a people and how to prepare and what was important and things of that nature. So singing was really, really a big deal for me. Growing up, music and instruments and what that was. And I took a great interest in it. You know, I didn't get into gospel until probably maybe the late 80s, early 90s. But all of that what was known as music, the heart of the black community and what we did, that was a big part. I would say when I was about 12, 13, I started getting into the acting. African dance at 11. I was just exposed. It was a good time to be exposed to so much, everything, anything, and finding your voice. It was just a really great time. I got into writing probably when I was about 17. Started writing, and we would enter into pageants and stuff, and that's, you know, speaking, doing spoken word was how I got to see like all of the East Coast, you know, and Canada, and going out west, you know, just because of being a part of the movement. And that was always what I told what I knew, just a rebel at all times.
Okay, thank you. You're going to get a chance to expound on that. The next question that I have for each of you has to do with where Bridgeport was as an artistic community at the time that you entered into, you know, your role, your coming into to bloom as an artist. So Wendy, I'll begin with you. What was, I know, early to mid-70s, right, would be the time when you entered Bridgeport's art scene. So how would you describe it?
But I never saw Bridgeport as being a cultural or an art scene. When I initially, you know, my little trips, this was before all the government programs, because the only thing that was here in the city of Bridgeport was parks and recreation. Right here at Newfield Park, that's when I started to explore creativity by arts and crafts. And one of the park leaders saw that I was interested in art. And like I say, I was very naive. I was in a restricted household. I mean, my mother was like this, when she said, whatever, we did. And so she never saw the worth in it. So, excuse me, I pursued something that I just had the strong desire that I was going to get into. And like later on, I got found out my favorite artist. But usually I had to sit in a room when I was the only black person, which was very hard to do and be creative. And sometimes the teachers didn't even know what to say to what style of work I was producing. So I think later on when the programs came in, ABCD, when they put the Art Center, put that program together, and they had the Outbridge, the drama, and that's when it started for me. And like, as I said, when the artists came through the Art Center, that's when I started, and Bridgeport is so much better. I mean, when they started putting those sculptures out there, I know the aesthetics of it, people can't understand, but they were saying, why is that junk up there and everything? I said, guys, you just don't know what's gone behind the concept and someone being creative, and they putting these pieces up throughout the city of Bridgeport. This is saying something for which I thought was culturally dry, because the only thing they really had was the Barnum Festival when they had that jury exhibit, which they eliminated, and I won an award in that. Well, that was my first award for a painting I did.
What year was that?
I think it was 76, something like that, 76. And so Bridgeport is a much better place. And I see all, I miss some of these things that are happening, to creative programs that are out there, you know, because I had taking care of my sister's kids. That put a pause on my creativity. I didn't have kids, so I had to concentrate. I had three from one sister, one from the other. And I didn't know nothing about raising, discipline. So it was a whole experience. So, but what I see now, I am so happy to see, and that they're pushing it, because I saw Bridgeport as a dry city culturally. And I think when the government programs did come in, and ABCD and the National Endowment of the Arts and everything, that's when it started. And I think people were taking notice. I admire you two, because I was never expressive. I mean, I don't like public speaking. I hated when I had to do a part or read a poem or anything. And I let my work speak for itself, but I wish I was more expressive, because I hear what you say about your poems and how you started. And I saw those programs, and I know people that started with the Outbridge and everything like that, but I just couldn't do it. And I like to dance, and I do dance, but no, you couldn't catch me out there.
So this time, this question, I'm going to ask chronologically, because I really want to create a timeline here for Bridgeport and its, you know, and its artistic evolution or growth. And so, Ina, if you would talk about the point at which you became active, particularly with programs in Bridgeport, and I'm thinking about things that you might have either participated in or you at least knew about, like Youth Bridge, like the Drama Club. So would you, and of course, ABCD's, the Art Center, which was first on Main Street, and then moved to the Gary Crooks Center at PT after the Gary Crooks tragedy. So if you would talk about that.
You know, it's interesting, Wendy, when you talk about being culturally dry.
Right.
Because literally, I can remember as a little girl, if my parents went to the Elks, they were dressed up. Like, things that they did in Bridgeport, whether you went to the Elks, if you went to it was a to-do. Like, they didn't, you know, if you had house parties, they were house parties. And everybody, for the most part, was pretty respectable.
I'm a member of the Elks.
Okay. So, I remember back in the about 69, when Hall Neighborhood House, because I'm a baby of Hall Neighborhood House, when Mr. Whitmore and and before George Pipkin came, it was Mr. Whitmore. Joyce Barnes has been there forever. But starting from that point, that's where we went, and Mrs. Elliott was our cultural person.
Right.
And then it was called Black History Week. Right. We didn't even have a Black History Month. We had Black History Week. But what she would do was create a test for us to submit. You know, you get the test, you find out as many answers as you could, and we would have winners.
I remember that.
And that would be the extent of cultural stuff until Harambe came along. And then when Harambe came along, Black and Hispanics got together, and we had this weekend-long affair that it was just awesome, powerful. So as
a reference, do you remember where it took place?
At Hall, it started at Hall Neighborhood House, and then it ended up at Washington Park. At Hall Neighborhood House in '74, I was crowned Miss Harambe. So that's how I remember.
A particular
era, but back in 69, 70, 71, 72, then it started falling off. From there, Upward Bound, Youth Bridge, and those programs that started coming into the city started coming in around 72, 73, it started becoming more and more popular. And then all of a sudden, we had places to go, things to do, and the Black Panther Party, of which my mother used to say, I better not catch you over there at that youth center. Because they would, they would feed us there, and the doctors would come, and the dentists would be there. And so my parents, and particularly from the South, there were things that were said that that they didn't know of. You know, my mother thought she was pro-Black until she saw Black. Then it was, you better not be hanging out over there. And so the arts, again, between the music, the community, what was coming into the city, and simultaneously what was coming into the city and drugs, kind of came in at the same time. Things were, you had to find your path in order not to fall in a path. And so I would say those were the beginning years, the late 60s, 68, 69, after tearing up the place because Dr. King was assassinated. But definitely my first year in high school, things were already rolling. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And so that brings me to Shauna. There's a bit of a chronological gap there. Mm-hmm. And I know you talked about the 80s, and I can remember things such as the Art Center, which began in 1970, closing in 86, and it literally faded away from sort of governmental neglect and lack of funding. And it was there, and it was vibrant, and it fed people culturally. It also fed people physically. It nurtured an entire city, and particularly the PT area, where people felt like it was an extension of their home, where people came and where it was children at first, and then parents and grandparents said, well, what's going on there? And they came in and started doing crochet, and I heard stories about Ben Johnson's mother teaching hula dancing, I think, or belly dancing.
It was belly dancing.
Belly dancing, yes. So there was this vibrant intergenerational art center that happened for a good 15, 16 years that some people have memory of, a lot of people have no knowledge of, and it's one of the reasons why we are doing the Art History, the Art Center exhibit, to remind people of what has been before, even as we are, I think, in my view, celebrating a renaissance of artistic expression in Bridgeport. The 80s and the drug trade devastated us with the moving out of significant industry, which created jobs for people who were high school educated or, you know, maybe some trade or college educated, but could make really good livings and send their children to trade schools or onto college and own homes, and it was upwardly mobile, and you didn't have to have a lot of education to do it, and you certainly didn't have to go into debt. But GE and AFCO and all of those companies leaving the city at the same time the drugs came in really laid the city to waste. So Shauna, now I want you to jump in after that bridge of the 80s and talk about the 90s to the present, and what, how has the artistic scene, we'll say, in Bridgeport, you know, how has it developed? How has it grown? And if so, yes, over the years, and what's the state of it presently?
It's strange because both of you have had like this whole external experience, community-based experience, it sounds like to me. And this question actually brings me back to the other question about who inspires you. Because my experience becoming an artist was within my family. It wasn't a community program or this movement or that movement. It was really just, my family is heavily infused with art. My grandfather with poetry and drumming, and my grandmother was a seamstress, and she would paint, and my father would draw, and my uncle is a legendary blues singer. My first introduction to the stage was watching him perform. So,
and what is his name?
Taj Mahal.
Yeah. He is legendary.
Yeah. And so he would take us, when they were touring this side of the country, he would come get me, and then I would do like Maine and Vermont and Connecticut, like all these places. To this day, if he's here, we go with him. It's within my family that I found creative outlets, and like I always had an art teacher. I still talk to my 8th grade art teacher on Facebook. Like it's weird. But it wasn't like I went to this program and that program and this. It's like we had home ec in 8th grade. Yeah. I still remember how to make the pillows. So now I make pillows when I'm doing craft fairs. Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, we did the weaving in camp, and I can still make pot holders. Like, there's those things that carried over. We did self-portraits in art class using light and transferring paper. And so now I understand how to create my face. Like, it wasn't like I was part of this and part of this and part of that. So, I don't know. I guess that's a very different thing. I've never had a part of my life that wasn't inclusive of art, because everybody in my family does art. My father did say that I'm the one who's gone the furthest as far as visual work. I'm doing what he wanted to do. And if I don't make it, maybe somebody who comes through me will do what I didn't do. I will say, when I came back here in 2001, I went to college in Boston. But ever before that, I was a poet in New York. Everybody thought I was from Brooklyn. I was out there so much, people really thought I lived there. And then I was at Northeastern in Boston. I was part of Blackout Arts Collective, and I was doing a lot of performing up there at the Piano Factory and the House of Blues and things like that. So when I came back here, there was a whole group of poets that I found myself among. But none of them knew how much I did before I got here. But I liked that, so I took it as like a learning opportunity, because everywhere else I'd been, people knew what I was capable of, and they had taught me. These people, I was a blank canvas. So I was working the doors at the poetry nights and going to all the ciphers. We would get together in each other's houses until 4 and 5 and 6 in the morning and write and share. And I think that's that community of doing that is what developed me. And then there was a spell when people's life changed, or they got married, or things happened and they moved, and it sort of dispersed. And then there was nowhere to do poetry. And I was like, this has been good. I had all these poems that I wanted to share, because now it becomes like an addiction, like you have to express yourself. And so that's how Lyrical Voices came about. It was just a deficit of places to be.
So talk about Lyrical Voices.
Lyrical Voices is my open mic series. I started, I want to say it had to be about, this was the 13th anniversary of last year. So it was about 2005 when I started it. And it was at Soda Soul Soul Food on the corner of Broad Street and John Street. Now it's Barnum Public House, but they closed. But it used to be a soul food restaurant. And I kept driving by there like, somebody should really do poetry there. And then somebody, like, why isn't it, I'm getting worked up. Why isn't anybody talking? Then I'm like, oh, maybe I'm supposed to do the poetry there. And I did it, and I really did it with the expectation that somebody would just take it over, but that never happened. And then it was weird because all the people I thought were gonna be there weren't, and then I was feeling some kind of way. But then it was like the room was packed to capacity. Like the restaurant was, it was like people were lining up, and I was like, okay, so focus on the people who are here, Sean. And it was, and then once the reputation of it grew, all the people I thought would be there started coming. And so then it turned into this huge thing, and I was like, it sort of snowballed on me. And people were traveling from like Mississippi and Virginia and North Carolina and Brooklyn and Maine, and I'm like, okay, let's go with it. And so, and there were literally nights, especially that restaurant was having a hard time, as many do downtown. And but there were nights, even when they were about to close, when there were, the windows were papered, it was the dead of winter, people in there with their coats on, it's packed to capacity and nobody cared. The restaurant was literally, we only had the keys and people were still there. And then we did, when they closed, there were, I was sort of bouncing around, trying to, struggling with whether I should keep doing it or not. But we got booked in these really random places. Before the Nest Factory was on
Elton State Street. Is that on Elton?
Now it's on State Street. But before it was on another street. It might be Elton. And it was in another factory that burned down now. But we got there and there was bacon and bird feathers all over the floor. There was no toilet paper. It was cold. I was crying. Buddha was like, Shauna, we got this. I'm like, no, we don't. There's bird feathers. But that night ended up, we cleaned it up, and that night ended up amazing. And it's like, it was nothing to do with me that just kept going. It was just really divine. And then we got over to the Innovation Center with Gerald Moore. He had a studio there. And we did that for about 3 or 4 years. And then I started to realize people were calling me, like, do you know any poets who can perform at this festival? It happened more than once. And so, yes, I do, me. And so I realized that my promotions were overtaking what people saw me as an artist. They forgot that I was an artist, too, which is why I started doing it quarterly. Then I started doing it annually, which is what I do now, because that wasn't more important to me than doing my work. It's important to me, but I don't want it to overshadow it. So I needed to really focus on my work and showing up in other ways, because now there's not a deficit. Lyrical Voices started, and then there came Poetry Realm, then there came Free to Spit, then there came all these other open mics, and I think Lyrical Voices is definitely different in a lot of ways, but they still offered a platform. So I wasn't obligated to have that one existing space, which is awesome. So now I do my own work a little more. And I do the writers group, which I really love. Yeah, it's a sacred space for people to create and write and explore who they are. And that has become a lot more than I thought it would, and I'm thankful for that. So, yeah, I think that I've never looked outside of myself as far as living in Bridgeport. I've never looked outside of myself for places to go. I've always created them. I've never been in an art program. I took one art class in college and I got a D. And I had like a 3.8 GPA. And you're not compromising. So there goes that. And it was a lot of competition. And at the time, I took paint as fun. It was a hobby. It wasn't a career. I was going to be a writer. So I didn't want it to ruin it for me. And so I stopped taking it. And I self-taught myself painting.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Now, I have a question for you all. Are you all familiar with each other's work? Okay.
I didn't know.
So if you would explain for those who might not know who's speaking, when you say, I am Ina.
Oh, okay.
Also, I'll say, Ina, are you familiar with either Shauna or Wendy's work?
Familiar with Shauna's work, not Wendy's work.
Okay, and Shauna, how about you?
I'm familiar with Ina's work and not Wendy's work.
Okay, and Wendy, are you familiar with either Shauna or Ina's work?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
She's about to be.
Yes.
We're about
absolutely.
To know each other.
Yes, exactly. This is a meeting of great minds and talent. Wendy, I would like to talk with you a little bit, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
Share about what it has been like to have a period of time, because I believe that once you're an artist, you're always an artist. You can never not be an artist. But there can be periods, there can be fallow periods, there can be dry periods, there can be, you know, periods of great bloom, periods of isolation, you know, and periods where life literally gets in the way of art, you know, or somehow causes you, for whatever reason, to put the creative expression on the back burner while you deal with a life issue. And so would you talk about that?
Well, dealing with raising the four kids and traumatized kids that have been through trauma, I just never thought I would have to deal with children. I got past that part where I thought I would have kids. That was it. I joined the Elks, and that's a social, and had a lot of programs within itself that I was active in. And then I was active in the community politically, and I also was a police commissioner for 13 years. So my energies went to other things, but I still kept my finger on it because I was doing this, I was doing flyers, I was doing journals, and got into face painting because of the police department, and it was those things, but working specifically on my own work, it just didn't happen that way, you know.
And for how many years did it not happen?
I know it was about 20 years because the kids were young. They were still in elementary school, and one hit high school. So that was all consuming. You know, I was for the interest, trying to make it be a buffer to make it easier for them to handle the situation, which was very hard. It was very hard for them.
And where are you in your artistic expression now?
Well, right now, as I said, I go down to Seaside Park when the weather's warm. I'm starting the watercolors. I've done a couple of paintings, but still not enough. I haven't really gotten full swing into my creativity like I used to before, and then everything stopped. So it's a small resurgence. It's starting, but I can't wait to go to Seaside Park and start the watercolors again. So, and then I still have here, because of here, I've gotten into weaving, painting on glass, a little bit of woodworking, a whole bunch of things. So, I had avenues that kept a slow burn, but I haven't come back to a full flame yet, as they say. But I'm nurturing it and bringing it back, and I'm really enjoying the watercolors.
Yeah. Earlier when you were saying you were doing the watercolors of the seascapes,
yes,
but they used to feel archaic to you?
No, that was the wrong word.
Okay. I'm just wondering why.
Yeah, no, archaic is the wrong word because doing watercolors is not an archaic medium. I never was interested in doing still lifes or landscapes. I thought it was just archaic. I didn't see no interest in what was the reason for it, but there is a reason for it because you got to start from the basics and the foundations of whatever craft you get into. Because you got to start from the 1, 2, 3 before you get into calculations. And that was the wrong term. I thought it was archaic. I didn't care for it. But now I see a whole new, different vision. I'm saying I was missing it. And I'm appreciating the art, the feel of it. I'm in this group that says watercolor addicts. Because once it gets a hold on you, you can say, I'm going to get it next time. I'm going to get it. It doesn't come that easy. It's constant. I mean, painting seems a little bit easier because I know what I want to do, where I'm at with it, painting, my style of painting. But watercolors, it's forever changing. And I've learned something.
It's a master of control to do watercolors.
Yes.
And I asked that because I had a similar perspective, on especially like still life, scenery, landscape.
Right.
But even the fact that you, for me, I found you have to do a lot of that in reverse, where I usually start dark to light. I have to start light to dark.
Right.
And just
how you use watercolor.
Oh, well, landscape.
Oh, I'm sorry. Landscape, you're saying. Landscape.
And still life. I always feel like I have this obligation to tell stories of people of color through my art because we don't get that enough.
Right.
And so there's been this guilt about just wanting to paint a water scene, right? And or even maybe a lack of interest or feeling like it's archaic because it's not enough.
Right.
But it is enough.
Yeah.
And like there's this need for very, very everyday mundane images of people of color that are not just revolution, but maybe just chilling. That is lacking and needs. And I don't know if it's necessarily lacking, but it's not as visible as like a Black Panther.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But it's necessary because we do just sit in circles or we do just get up and look out the window and that doesn't get captured. But what do we see? So our perspective of those is very different.
There's an artist that I love. His name is Dean Mitchell, and I know what you're saying, but he was born in a rural city in town in Florida. You should see his stuff, and he won an award for this picture of a buffalo soldier. And the images that he said, I wish I could paint like that man. And he started off as nothing, and he's got into watercolor as a fluke. His stuff is awesome, and he does images of Black people in the rural South, or he's done out in the Southwest. And I love the Southwest. I visited once. I love it. And I just never visualized there were Black people out there, but there are Black people out there.
So, we are everywhere. Everywhere.
Yes.
We started at the beginning, and we are everywhere.
Yes.
Shauna, you said something that sparked a question for me that I want all of you to weigh in on. When you talked about seeing us as Black people in the most mundane of settings, and you talked about versus a revolutionary sense, and as you were talking, I'm thinking, you know, seeing us in the most mundane ways, considering the way in which we've been perceived, is revolutionary. Mm-hmm. To see us be mothers, fathers, teachers, homemakers, whatever, drinking coffee, walking to the store, you know, is revolutionary in light of the ways in which we're often portrayed. And so I'm wondering for each of you, you know, as a Black person, as a Black woman, as a woman, as an artist, as someone who might or might not be political, as someone who might or might not be concerned about a specific cultural voice, where does art play a role in who you are and in who your makeup? So, Shauna, let's begin. Look, Ina, let's begin with you and me. What is art in your makeup?
Well, for me, the reason why I started Emerging Voices Production Company is because I wanted to produce more of what we see less of, which is my mantra is from page to stage. which is based on historical writings with a current, what is the current parallel and or twist. History is a big thing for me, from Africa to America, from South to North, from North to West. There's a lot of things that have gone into my brain over the last 30 years about who we are as a people and where we come from and what to expect and what we have not been taught. So I use theater as a way to tell stories. I started telling the bigger story as a director and a writer for the Ma'afa at Mount Airy Baptist Church. And what that did for me when we were introduced to it in 2000 was to allow me to understand that ministry, as we know church ministry, is bigger than that. And so it allowed me to be able to step outside the box and to be able to take our stories and bring them to life and teach who we are, what we are, so that when we say, I think that we buy into some stuff that's very elusive over the years. You know, people will say, you know, we're not family oriented. No, we've always been family oriented. We, you know, the absenteeism of fathers and all of that. There are lots of us who grew up with fathers and mothers and a whole family unit and the grandparents and so on and so forth. And so where our breakdowns have begun, people take that and they magnify our missteps and they don't tell the totality of our stories and our struggles and what we've been through as a people. And so therefore we lose something. And we're just here to help find it again and to let people know, to let the children know, to remind people that it's necessary to tell your story, because we all have stories. There are some stories that we like to forget, but they're part of our makeup, the good, the bad, the ugly. It's a part of who we are, and it lends to our strengths. So it's important to tell our children our stories. It's important that they know where they come from. It's important that we're able to do the things we do because of. Yet at the same time, when we're building, what we need to do is build upwards and not try to recreate a wheel, because the wheel's already been set. What our ancestors have done for us, we can't redo. If we could, we would have redone it by now. But instead of trying to always start over, it's like the bad diet, you know? You just keep starting over. And the key is, don't start over. Start from where you left off. Build on top of that. And so we are a powerful people. And, you know, God has been the base of that. Whether, you know, and how we have gotten through as a people. I think it was in the 80s when the big thing that me, myself, and I became the new mantra of the U.S. of A. And black people got involved in that me, myself, and I. We are interdependent people. We depend on one another. That's how we've been able to make it through. And we got to get back to that. We are interdependent on each other and dependent upon God. That's how we made it. So, and it's how we will continue to make it. We're not going anywhere, but we can do better. And so I use art as that tool to always express, I'm going to take you back to where we are so you understand the root of that. But let's not only stay at the root of that, because we are the offsprings. And those of us that are left are the remnants. And so as remnants, we have stories to tell. There's a job we have to do. There are things we need to do. And I think that we don't give our young people enough credit or enough room to grow. Because we, you know, just don't want to let it go. Just don't want to let it go. You know, and as a baby boomer watching through the civil rights, and it's almost like, you know, we thought when segregation, and I always question this, civil rights, was it good for us or not? In the sense that when we talk about integration and segregation, integration has allowed not only for us to move out, but to leave behind. And we have literally, there are tons that have left behind. I'm not going back there no more. You ain't got to talk to me about that. I don't want to know nothing about that. And we got to change that. We got to go back and get one and bring them along with us.
Should we have been asking for desegregation rather than integration?
I think that what we wanted was, I think initially what we wanted was just equal. That's what we wanted.
Equalization.
Right? That's what we wanted. We didn't care about being integrated. What we wanted was to stay in the spots that we were in, but that for you to
have
be
the same
fair,
quality.
The same quality of life was what we were asking for.
Didn't want to be around white folks.
Exactly. You know?
But we wanted the same access to books. We wanted the same funding of infrastructure. We wanted the same opportunities.
That's exactly what we wanted. And this thing got so twisted and turned around. And now, and what we ended up with, because white folks didn't want to be around black folks, so they pulled. They separated themselves anyway. So we're right back where we started from, for the most part. Except we have been left without the tools. What we didn't have before, we definitely don't have now. And with this present administration, it is their sole intentions that if you're poor, you make it the best way you know how. And in 2018, that's a shame.
So, Sean, the same question for you about art, womanhood, and culture, and how those things inform you in your work, if at all.
I think that art informs my whole life. And sometimes to a point where it's like I said, I see everything in detail. So almost to a point where it can be even in hindering.
Mm-hmm.
As much as it's blossomed me, I can't see past seeing everything in detail. There's a lot of people who can see a situation or a chair, right? Mm-hmm. And not look at it in depth. And I have to look at everything in depth, which can take a very long time. So I think that art informs me in every way. I think womanhood, I paint a lot of women. I paint a lot of women of color. And I talk about a lot of women's issues. And I think the same question that you posed about race, about if we want equality or inclusivity, I think equality is what we are reaching for. Also, but it's weird because I think there's this expectation that things should shift overnight, and I don't know that that's a realistic expectation because people are stuck in very old ways, and to expect someone to change in a moment because we say so is not fair. But I do think that when you have a perspective or an idea of how the world should work and you don't express it, you're not adding to the conversation and you're not adding to change. So I think for me, I feel like I need to speak my piece because right now is the only time I have to do it. And if I don't, especially as a visual artist, it's like when you go to a museum and you don't know the context of a painting, so you make up all these scenarios for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you hear a poem and you don't know the context of what happened to get to that poem. So you have all these different scenarios for it. Like right now is the only time we have to say this is how it happened. This is how it got here. And so for me, as a woman, I need you to know how I got here. How I got to this perspective or this feeling. You know, I look at the whole Danny Glover, Donald Glover, Childish Gambino,
yeah.
Uh-huh. This is America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this whole Kanye slavery. Mm.
Volunteer slavery.
All of that stuff is like, it's horrible, but there are people who think like this. You know, this is a real perspective for a lot of people, and that scares me. And so as an artist, I have the opportunity to offer the alternate perspective, the alternate reality, my reality. And I've actually struggled a lot in the recent months. with the conversation of is advocacy as an artist sufficient, or are you required on some level to be an activist at the same time? Because there's a lot of people I see who are fine with just the advocacy, but I've always known myself to be an activist through my art on some level. And especially as you get older, you don't have the energy for a lot of stuff because the chronic Black fatigue can get real.
Yeah.
You kind of play with the idea, is advocacy enough now? Do I make room for other people? How will I make room? But then you see some ignorance blow up and you're like, oh God, here I have to go. You know? And I know that's how generations before me have felt.
Yeah.
And so there is a point where you sort of have to let go and let the world do what it's going to do, because it's going to do it regardless. But I think it's a blessing as a creative person to be able to add your voice and your perspective and what you know to the conversation. And when we're not here anymore, they're going to do what they want to do with it anyway. But at least you said it now.
That was the thing for me. 100 years from now, I think that what the artist has to say now is how is going to be the point of reference for generations to come, to look back, to have a point. Because that becomes the issue. When there is no point of reference, I can make up what I want for your history. So it's important to know your history so that someone doesn't put on you how they see your point of reference. And so I think it's important for the artist to speak and to advocate as well as articulate the ills of society. You know, yeah, it's tiring, and yeah, but if we don't, you know, it's like omission is consent. So we got to speak up.
Now, I have a final question for each of you. Same question. And I'm going to begin with Shauna this time. And is there something unique or special and or important about being a Black woman artist in Bridgeport?
Yes.
And what is that?
So I've gone into some schools, and I've grew up going to schools, but even going back today, you don't get to learn about Black artists. You learn about Emily Dickinson and Sappho and just artists who are not of color. And we're just as relevant as any of them and necessary, especially among our own people. I think when it comes to art, we always have to self-educate when it comes to people of color. I know that for a fact. And so in a city like Bridgeport, which is predominantly of color, not even just Black, but Hispanic and African and everything, Brazilian and everything else, seeing brown and Black artists is necessary because we tell their stories and we're living their experience. And we also, a lot of people don't know, especially depending on how they're brought up, don't know that they have the ability, the right to say what happens to them. And I think especially in communities of color, we're taught to present a facade. And so the artist of color really is a rebel in the way of telling the truth. When we've been taught our whole life, just make it okay, just assimilate, just do this so you'll survive. And then here comes an artist like, that's the police, and you know what I mean? Or Black love is Black power, and you know, like Nikki Giovanni says, Black love is Black wealth. And it shouldn't be revolutionary, right? It should be just common knowledge, but it's not. And so the fact that it's not, and that you're an artist of color, and you're a woman, and you're speaking out, and you're vocal, and you're present. And I go to these shaping community conferences and workshops, and they're talking about all the different ways to build up the city, and I'm speaking very bluntly about, well, gentrification is not the answer, you know? We have. and it's like, as an artist, they value your voice, but as you also have to make sure that you still speak up even when it's uncomfortable for everybody. And holding that stake can be very challenging because you know there's going to be some things you're not invited to. There's going to be some things they don't want you to say that at.
Yeah.
But you have to do it anyway. It goes beyond the canvas, is what I guess what I'm trying to say, into like social activity and the development of the community and making sure you and your culture are represented. There's a whole history of Little Liberia that's lost on most of this city.
Yes.
And being part of expressing my feelings and my knowledge of that has just been empowering to kids who haven't learned it. You know, I was in the peer docent program and they're learning the architectural history of the city. So they're learning about McLevy Hall and how Lincoln went there and how Bridgeport Machines, they had the first weapons that aimed properly. So Hitler wanted to hit Bridgeport first so he could take out those machines. They're learning about the Arcade Mall and the Barnum Museum. Mm-hmm. And then I added Little Liberia. And at the end of the weeks that we taught with them, they were asked what was their favorite part, and Little Liberia is what they said. Because they never heard about that because it was people like them, because they were so affluent and you know, able.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a city where people act like everything is dead, and it's not. And it's actually quite empowered despite the shell.
Mm-hmm.
The soul is full. So I think as an artist woman and artist of color, it's special because I have, it wouldn't be if I didn't use my voice, and it wouldn't be if I didn't share, but because I do those things. And I'm of service, being of service is what makes it special.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Wendy, how about you? Is there anything special or unique and or important about being a black woman artist in Bridgeport?
I feel it's very important. I always did it in a different, subtle way. Teacher at Sheridan had asked me to do something for Black History Month, and I'm so good at cutting out papers. I did this one of... I'm sorry, the name escapes me, the author who wrote The Three Musketeers. Mm-hmm. They were not aware it was a black man who wrote The Three Musketeers,
right.
Or The Count of Monte Cristo.
Right.
And I also did one of Queen of Sheba. And I always wonder behind that remark about the Queen of Sheba, and I found out that she was real. And to me, from antiquity, there was the first statement saying, I'm black and I'm beautiful. She says, I don't know if I'm saying it right for the Bible, Solomon, I am black, but comely, O ye daughters of Israel. I don't know. But they didn't know.
Yes, Simon
know
most
about
certainly
this.
Knew about Sheba.
Yeah, and they didn't know about that. So I picked out two things. And I also used the Queen of Sheba when I was taking a course that gives computer graphics. We had to do this whole like campaign. I had to do this menu, and I made a shopping bag and a stationery and everything, and we had to put a campaign in a cooking magazine. And I had one page in black and white saying she took a trip, she was dressed in her best with 10,000 attendants, with elephants, camels, and like $3 million worth of the gold and jewelry and all this kind of stuff. And the next page I put, all for a man. Because she had to want to find out was it true about Solomon. Yeah, and the lady thought it was fantastic, and nobody in the class, they thought Queen of Sheba was, you know, Makeda the Beautiful. So I think it's very important that your art is used to inform.
Yeah.
And people would think, oh, really? Where do you get that from? And I've always been told that I'm crazy. They said, because you're an artist, like when I got my sister's kids, and I took them out shopping, let's go eat, I took them to the mall, and they said, oh,
Aunt Wendy, let's get our ears pierced. I said, okay. Man, the family talked about me, but you know she's an artist. You know she's crazy. So and the women have to push themselves, yes, promote themselves, because yes, for years we've been second-class citizens. I remember being in an art group where we stood up because it seemed like they were promoting the male artists and not the women artists. And I remember going to a school where we all went through, Lehigh School's not there anymore, and we presented our work and we talked, and they kept on talking about this one class that was terrible and was mostly women, girls. And they gave everybody a hard time, but when they saw me and I was the only female artist, they realized that women do things. And so I feel it's very important as a woman and to promote ourselves as women, yes, who are doing stuff. Yes. And listen, I put it up there. If you don't believe it, you go research and find it yourself, and hopefully it will lead on to other things for you. So it's very important. It's a strong part of me, and I just know I'm bringing it back out.
Yes. Ina, same for you. Something special, unique, and/or important about being a Black woman artist in Bridgeport?
I have this saying that says we are strong enough to think a nation and birth it too. That's a Black woman. And, I think that as Black women, and as you know, for all the things that I've been able to accomplish thus far, I don't allow my age or my stage to be something that I don't believe in stopping because you reach a particular plateau in life. As a female firefighter, I can accomplish that. As a person that's in the community, I can accomplish that. As a mother that have to raise children, I can accomplish that. As a woman minister, I can accomplish that. So I have learned that as Black women, wherever we desire to put our work to, whatever God has called us to put our hands to the plow to, not only do we pull the plow and plant the seeds and water the grass with our tears and give what we have, it is just important. It's important for us to touch our children because, or anything for that matter, because as you know with vibration, if you don't speak to it, it don't grow. And so our voices as artists, whether by paintings, singing, whatever our hands touch, there is growth. And so I think we need to encourage each other in that. I think we need to lift each other in that, in the sisterhood of artists. I think that there's so much room, space, and growth for everybody. Mm-hmm. For everybody. There are things that we need to let go of that have been put on us. There's no such thing as competition, but that we are all competent in what we do. And so I think that for me, I'm just here to support wherever I can, whoever I can. That's important to me, to lift people up. And yeah, you get hurt along the way, you know, because sometimes you put yourself out there and everybody who say that they like you or like your work don't. And it's okay. Yeah. And it's so, and you have to know that it's okay that you don't have to like it because there's somebody else who does. But for me, it's I don't know. I don't know how to say all of that because I can just go on and on and on. But I think that we are special. I think that we've been created in such a marvelous way. And I think that the reason why we get so much resistance is because everybody else sees our light, but they don't need you to see it. If you're the one who don't see what it is that you're worth, then I can keep you underfoot and under control. And so for that, you know, I am the rebel. I'll continue to be the rebel. And it's just the call that I have to lift us up and to help you look in the mirror and see yourself and see the divine creation that you are, and that your voice matters. What you have to say and what you do matters. As Black women, we matter. And we're